You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Only 22 women have run for president in the United States. And that's counting at least one who wasn't that serious about it. Comedian Gracie Allen announcing her 1940 campaign here with George Burns.
George, I'll let you in on a secret. I'm running for president.
You're running for president?
Yes.
Gracie, how long has this been going on?
Well, for 150 years. George Washington started it.
But in the entire history of the United States, there's never been a woman president.
Well, yeah, isn't that exciting? I'll be the first one.
Vote for Gracie.
Vote Gracie.
That was a publicity stunt at the time. But over 80 years later, there's still never been a woman president of the United States. There have been very serious campaigns, though, by women running for the White House in recent years, six of them in the 2020 election alone. Our next guest covered the 2016 and 2020 elections and spent a lot of time with many of those women running for the White House. She wanted to dig into why none of these women have broken through that presidential glass ceiling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we haven't had a woman as president yet? Did you have a favorite candidate or a dream candidate maybe who hasn't even run? Tell us about that preference and why. Do you think that the deck is stacked in some ways against women who might want to run for the White House? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Allie Vitale is an NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent. Her new book is called Electable: Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. Allie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. So excited to be with you.
As I mentioned, you've covered a lot of presidential candidates, many of them women. What led you to tackle this issue, this theme in your new book?
Well, I continuously found myself drawn to female candidates. That's even true when I'm at my day job at the U.S. Capitol, where I am now. So any of the echoes or bings of the of the empty U.S. Capitol, that's the explanation for it. But for me, I was always drawn to these women in part because they were trying to do something that had never been done before. But also because myself, as a woman, I was able to see some of these more misogynistic stereotypes and tropes being applied to them. And my hope was that I could disrupt those narratives before they started. And that's also my hope for the book, is that in walking through moments from the 2020 campaign that many of us all just lived through or followed, or in my case, in your case, reported on, going back through those moments and applying a gender lens to them. And being able to explain, yes, the politics of those moments, but also the unquantifiable impact of gender.
One big issue that comes up again and again in your reporting in the book with a bunch of women running in the Democratic primary, this idea of electability. And I think a common mindset among voters, maybe politicians and others who think, okay, I personally, they might say, would happily vote for a woman, but all those other people won't. That's going to hurt us in the general election. So maybe I don't vote for a woman in the primary. Could you talk about that hurdle to overcome?
That is one of the key things that I was hearing in real time as I was traveling the country, both in 2016 and again in 2020, this doubt of whether a woman could ultimately clear this final hurdle. And that's something that in 2016, the question was answered for the country, which is that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and it answers the question of whether or not the country was ready to elect a female president. It turns out they were, just not by the metric that we actually elect presidents by, which of course is the Electoral College. And then in 2020, it became the question to ask the female candidates was, how do you do something that has never been done before? And I think that one of the important things that I point to in the book is it's not patently unfair to ask if this candidate can win. It's a question that voters apply to both men and women who are trying to run for office. Everyone wants to be able to pick a winner. But at the same time, for the women, it was always a question of who are we giving the benefit of the doubt to? And generally speaking, voters seemed a little bit more ready to give the benefit of the doubt of winning to a man, especially when Donald Trump was introduced to the picture. I think one of the striking things was I spoke with many of the women who ran in 2020 and in 2016 for this book, everyone from Carly Fiorina, who was the only woman on the 2016 Republican side, to Secretary Hillary Clinton herself. And many of them point to the fact that Trump was a complicating factor for an already complicated quest of being the first female president.
Now, you noted in the book, 1978, that's the first year that we have a woman elected to the U.S. Senate who wasn't a spouse of the previous holder of that seat. We had Geraldine Ferraro running for vice president in 1984. Now it seems like, at least in some ways, in the primary campaigns, the dam is breaking. You mentioned Carly Fiorina, Michelle Bachmann on the Republican side, yes. Sarah Palin, of course, vice presidential nominee, this bunch of women. So it does seem like the tide is slowly turning here.
It's turning in a few different ways. I think that the pipeline right now of qualified, viable women is so much fuller on both sides. And that's a really good progress point, especially as you look ahead to future election cycles, where I really do believe that we are done with the days of only white men running for president in both primary fields, Republican and Democrat. The caveat, of course, is that 2024 itself is right now governed by two older white men, because Joe Biden is the president of the United States and he says he's going to run for president again. And Donald Trump is the former president of the United States and he says he's going to run again. Nevertheless, it does seem like there's progress being made both in the pipeline, but then also you speak to the idea of Geraldine Ferraro being the first female vice presidential nominee on the Democratic side, Sarah Palin many years later in 2008 with John McCain. The thing that both of those nominations have in common is the fact that both of the campaigns that chose the female running mates were kind of at a low point for mm-hmm. them. Polling wise, they were lacking energy. It was sort of a throw spaghetti at the wall and see what can energize the electorate move. In 2020, Joe Biden, at the apex of his political power, knew that it would be an asset to have a woman on the ticket with him, and ultimately chose Kamala Harris. And that in and of itself is a major shift from the other moments when we've seen women nominated as vice presidential contenders, because this was something where Biden was saying having a woman on the ticket is an asset. It's not just something that I hope might work to gin up the base.
Ali Vitale is with us, NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent, joining us from the Capitol. We're talking about her new book. It's called Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. The media, Ali, how did you see, as you went through this 2020 campaign in particular, how did you see the media, maybe the media is a big word, but in general, the media treating those women running for the Democratic nomination versus the men running for that same nomination?
Well, look, I think that part of what I do in the book as a member of the media, which is a big word, but it counts, especially in terms of who's following these candidates around on the campaign trail from Iowa to New Hampshire and everywhere in between, is it's in the questions that we ask. And one of the things that I talked about with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, for example, was we had a tendency to ask these female candidates, do you think that you can win and make history? Which the framing of that question innately puts these candidates on the defensive. But the other piece of this too, and thankfully, I think most reporters had been trained out of this line of thinking over the course of the preceding presidentials, was the idea of likability. It's certainly a metric that was applied to Hillary Clinton in 2008 and again in 2016, but it was still something that even if we weren't asking directly about likability, I think likability got put into play as electability and became sort of its own gendered metric, even as people wised up to the fact that talking about candidates being likable really only cut against women. I do think that there's certainly progress that needs to be made. And one of the things that I say in the book is that having more women and people of color in newsrooms and in press corps on the campaign trail makes it so that more candidates' lived experiences can be highlighted and can be seen as authentic and can be explained and contextualized in the right way. But I do still think that there's progress to be made on that front as well, needing more diversity in newsrooms and needing to amplify more voices that are not just straight, white, and male, which is the typical lens that news media tends to come through still.
You followed Senator Elizabeth Warren a lot on the campaign trail. I want to give a listen to Senator Warren in January of 2020, not long before she ended up dropping out of the race, talking about this question of whether a woman could win. Here's a listen.
The world has changed since 2016. Once Donald Trump was inaugurated, you may remember what happened the very next day. Biggest protest rally in the history of the world. Women turned out and said, wow, I'm going to get deeper into politics. So what happened? In 2018, we took back the House. We took back state houses around this country. Why? Because of women candidates and women who got out to support and help make sure that Democrats got elected. What the data show are that women candidates have been outperforming men candidates in competitive elections since Donald Trump was elected. Let's face it, women win.
2018, she mentioned. You also talked to a Republican organizing group that saw some successes for Republican women going into Congress. There, at least some parts of both parties are putting a focus, maybe not at the presidential level, but in Congress. What did we see?
Well, it starts in Congress, right? It starts in Congress. It starts in state houses, mayoral races, gubernatorial races. That's the way that these parties fill the pipeline. And look, Elizabeth, Senator Warren is right in that women have been winning at the same or greater rates than men when they run. And part of the reason why I focus on the primary so much in this book is because it's primary elections, not general elections, where you see gender and race most at play and most at risk of harming female or person of color candidacies. And so that's why it's so important in this book to focus on the primary perspective here. But look, 2018, I think, was a moment in most recent memory for Democrats of seeing major gains made in the House from women and people of color candidates. And then again in 2020, Republicans were able to make significant gains, especially in highly contested, closely watched seats and races, in part because they put forward good, strong candidates who were women. And so what one Republican organizer and operative told me is that 2020 was a proof point for a party, the Republican Party, that does not like to put gender first, does not like to campaign identity forward. That's something that the conservative grassroots typically balk at and candidates are very aware of. But at the same time, the party apparatus saw the return on investment of good, strong female candidates. That is not to say, and I think there's an interesting thing happening on the Republican side of this right now, is that Republican women like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert are exactly the kind of candidates who are doing very well on the fringe of the Republican Party. It makes sense as to why, because they are trying to prove their ideological credentials and fealty to Trump. But what several Republican operatives have said to me is that because of the rise of those kinds of candidates, they have also felt the need to qualify the kind of Republican woman that they will support, which is to say they've added disclaimers on their websites that they support qualified female candidates, not candidates who trade in conspiracy theories and other things like we see from the far right of the party right now.
We're talking NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Ali Vitale about her new book, Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a woman yourself, is it important to you to have a woman become a president in your lifetime in the next 4 to 8 years? Why or why not? And for anybody out there who struck you as a great candidate among the women who ran in the last 8 or 10 years in their respective primaries, who would you like to see run? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Ali Vitale, NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent, looking at her new book. It's called Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a woman as president of the United States in the next X number of years? Is this something that's important to you? Women out there listening, is this something you've been hoping to see in your lifetime? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Eric is with us in Hazel Green. Eric, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to mention that I'm actually old enough to be one of the small amount of voters who voted for Geraldine Ferraro, Mondale Ferraro. And over my years, I was at one time a Republican, and I was hoping that Condoleezza Rice would have run. She is someone I really would have voted for.
Eric, thanks for that call. We actually heard from Joel on Facebook, who also put in a vote for Condoleezza Rice for the first woman president. She is somebody much talked about, I think, Ali, but never actually took the plunge.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But that's not to say that Republicans aren't going to have good female options, I think. If I'm sort of looking into my presidential crystal ball, as I sometimes like to do, there's clearly a pile of talent on the conservative side of this. People like former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, as well as South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. And then, of course, you think, for example, of Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who has all but said that she's actively thinking about a presidential run. Hers, of course, is meant to prevent Donald Trump from getting another term. But I think that Republican leadership right now has a lot of women swelling in their ranks. Even if I think about in the halls of Congress, you have Elise Stefanik, who took Cheney's place in Republican leadership here. So certainly over the course of the last few years, there is a good group of women who are coming up who could mount viable presidential campaigns on the other side. Though, I don't know, I can't speak for Condoleezza Rice, but of course, it makes sense why people might put her in that mix as well as someone who they would like to see run, given her experience on the world stage as well.
Thanks for that, Colin. Ali, you talk about in your book, like historically in a lot of other countries, the first woman prime minister or president or whatever was often on the conservative side. And you heard a prediction possibly even from Hillary Clinton, who said she didn't like it, but she thought there was a decent chance that the first woman president might be a Republican.
That's exactly right. Somewhat surprising, but of course, Clinton was very quick to clarify with me that she doesn't want to see a conservative woman get there first, but that history tells us that that's something that has happened time and again. And I think the other thing to think about here when you consider why the U.S. hasn't elected a female president yet is the system by which we do it. We talked earlier in our conversation about the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but not the Electoral College. If you look at other countries, England, for example, women tend to do well in parliamentary systems, places where they're elected to a governing body and then elevated by their peers as the head of that governing body. Of course, if that were the way that the U.S. did it, we would have a prime minister or a President Nancy Pelosi already, but that's obviously not the U.S. system.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pam is with us in Oconto. Pam, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I very, very much think that we're behind the times by not having put a female in office as president. You look at other industrialized countries, and they've had women in office that have done wonderfully. Women are great multitaskers, and I do feel that we have some very strong women in politics that would be wonderful presidents. One of them, I think, is Liz Cheney. She is very intelligent. She knows the law. She follows the law. And I think that she would be a great president for our country.
Pam, thanks a lot for the call. Ali, run with that where you want to go. Are you there, Ali? I think we've lost.
Yes, hi.
Oh,
I am
there you are. Okay.
No, I'm here. Despite multiple years of the pandemic, the mute button is still elusive to me, apparently.
We've all been there. Some of us earlier today, for that matter.
Oh, good. I'm not alone. But look, I think that what your caller says makes a lot of sense, especially at this moment where on the conservative side of the spectrum, you have sort of the accountability movement of former President Donald Trump being led in large part by women, not just Vice Chair Liz Cheney in her role on the January 6th committee, but also in the former members of Trump's administration, Cassidy Hutchinson, Sarah Matthews, who came forward to testify. And then if you look at the state level, who's doing these investigations, you have the Attorney General in the state of New York, as well as the DA in Fulton County, both women. And so they are very much at the forefront of the conversation around the former president and accountability. That's one of the key pieces. And then, you know, if you look on the Democratic side of things, we haven't yet talked about the fact that Vice President Kamala Harris is historic. Although it's not a woman in the Oval Office as president, she has risen further than any woman has before. The first woman and person of color in that role, it's extremely impactful. And in my conversations with both Republican and Democratic operatives, everyone agrees that having Kamala Harris in that position does make the road a little bit smoother for anyone who might come after her. Because all of this at the end of the day is about imagination. It's asking voters to imagine a woman in the White House. And that's an extra step that male candidates don't have to go through. Yes, they're asking voters to imagine them, that individual, whoever they are, as president. But women candidates have to take it a step further. And having Kamala Harris there in a high-ranking executive role allows a little bit less imagination at play and a little bit more ability for the country to realize what it would look like to have a woman in those spaces. And it's not just a question of representation mattering, though certainly I've heard that from women across the country, but it's also a question of what kind of policy gets pushed to the fore. The fact that the White House, for example, is focusing so heavily right now on reproductive access, on Black maternal mortality, those are things that Kamala Harris has been key in keeping at the forefront of the conversation.
Time for one more caller. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
Yeah, so this might be a bit of a silly or redundant question. It maybe has already been addressed on this program, but one of the questions that really stuck with me is, what's the best way for, I guess, women and Black and brown candidates to win primaries, like, you know, whether it's presidential or gubernatorial or Senate primaries? Like, what's the most efficient and, I guess, also safest way for them to win those primaries without having to focus too intensely on their identities or having to prove themselves otherwise?
Jack, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Allie, you gave an example of Kristi Noem and how she framed some of those things, addressing gender without putting it, I don't know. She had this interesting needle threading you talk about.
And that's something that you see on the Republican side a lot, but it is something that it depends which party you're running in. And I really do think that it's part of your identity. You show up how you show up. At a certain point, you're going to have to talk about gender and your lived experience because people want to get to know their candidates. But at the end of the day, that's not the only thing that these women bring to the table. And you see them clearing qualification metrics time and again. And I talk about the politics in the book, too, because I'm a political reporter first. I love political campaigns, but that's also part of this picture.
Jack, thanks for the call. And Allie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Allie Vitale is an NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your nominations, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. According to biologists, there have been 5 known mass extinction events in the history of life on Earth. The last one happened roughly 66 million years ago when the dinosaurs were most likely wiped out by an asteroid. And it appears there's another one going on right now. The current mass extinction is unique in that its source is largely human activity. The UN Convention on Biological Diversity estimates that about 150 species die off each day, a number that can be difficult to wrap our heads around. Our next guest says there's something that can help us comprehend these extinctions. She takes a close look at the stories of endlings, a word used to mean the last individual left in a species, like Lonesome George, the last Pinta Island tortoise who died in 2012, and Benjamin, the Tasmanian tiger who died in 1933. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is there an endangered species close to your heart? Do you think the current mass extinction can be stopped or slowed down? Have you visited the Passenger Pigeon Memorial here in Wisconsin? Have you done conservation work yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lydia Pine is a writer and historian. Her most recent book is Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Endling was a new word to me, I got to say, Lydia, and it's pretty new in and of itself. Can you talk about the origins of this word endling?
Sure. So, pardon me. So, as you pointed out, an endling is defined as the last known individual of a species before that species goes extinct. And the word sort of came into being around 1996 when biologists were doing conservation work, but also working with people who had come to understand that they were going to be the last of their family. And we're looking for a word that would sort of have a poignancy about what it would be to be the end of something. And a couple of different words are tried out in the literatures, but endling is the one that sticks. It's really specific, it's really interesting, and it really piques a kind of curiosity, I think.
A big point of your book is that it matters how we talk about extinction and about these species and their last members. How does the word endling help do that, do you think?
So I think endling is a word that is really easy to gravitate toward. I joke that it took a long time when I was writing the book. It took a long time for Word to stop auto-correcting endling to ending. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a real sort of crossover between endling and ending and sort of how we think about extinction and the ends of things. And I think endling is a word that gives us a character to build out extinction stories around.
You end the book, if you don't mind me spoiling your last line, quoting here, "We owe it to these endlings to tell their stories in as many words and narratives as possible." Why is that?
So So when I was digging into the history of endlings and how we talk about these last of their species and these last survivors, I was really struck by how Western-centric these stories are, that we could find echoes of these stories in classic works like Beowulf or the King Arthur legend or all sorts of these sort of classic pieces of literature. And I wanted to, as part of this book, I wanted to be able to expand the kinds of literature and the kinds of words and the kinds of stories that we could use to talk about extinction and hopefully have a richer understanding of what loss means.
One practical hope, I think, for talking about these endlings, these last members of their species, would be, I guess, a cautionary tale. We have lots of those in the history of stories here. Something that tells us, hey, by the time it's gotten to this last one, it's too late, and maybe inspires us to care for other species. That's just one narrative. Is that an important one, though?
I think it is. I see these sort of cautionary tales. It feels like they almost function like an Aesop's Fables, like a modern Aesop's Fables, where these stories hopefully inspire a kind of lesson or sort of inspire us to be better humans or inspire us to consider these animals in their own stories. And I think that endlings are a way of putting that kind of character, putting a face, a persona onto something that's really abstract. So when you kicked off the segment, you pointed out that estimates put about 150 species a day going extinct. And I personally think that that's really hard to wrap my mind around, it's horrible, but it's very abstract. But when I dig into the story of Benjamin the Thylacine or Lonesome George the Galapagos Tortoise, suddenly I feel like I have an understanding that simply statistics and numbers don't necessarily provide.
Talking to Lydia Pine about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. You can join in with your thoughts, your concerns about endangered species, your question for our guest about this concept of endlings, the last of a species. 800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join in. 800-642-1234. I want to meet some of the endlings. And you just mentioned one, Benjamin the Thylacine or Tasmanian tiger, some people call him. First of all, tell us a little bit about this species.
Sure. So the species, the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, I think in some literatures they're also called Tasmanian wolves or hyenas, was a species that was common in Australia and Tasmania about 2 million years ago. And up through Europe, and it slowly goes extinct over the Australian mainland. And then by the time European settlers reach Tasmania, there are about 5,000 thylacines on the island of Tasmania. European settlers hunt the thylacine to extinction. It's really quite a vicious sort of extinction event in the 19th and early 20th century. And eventually, the last thylacine, the last known thylacine, is a captive thylacine that we've come to call Benjamin, who lived in a zoo in Hobart until he died in 1936 from exposure from the elements. It's really quite a tragic death to a sad extinction event.
Right. I got to say, in the storytelling here, and I'm putting human terms on an animal, which we do it, it seemed very undignified. Like the last member of the species was treated with very little dignity. Can you talk about that?
It feels oftentimes, I think, really cruel. And I think that it also helps us to really put actions and consequences together. Again, having a character or a persona or a specific individual, I think, helps us understand the actions and consequences in ways that I think are more abstract when we talk about bigger populations or species in general.
And Benjamin, I mean, the story that ends up being told about this thylacine, this Tasmanian tiger, first of all, he wasn't Benjamin. And I don't think, if I read right, he wasn't a he.
Yeah, so the debate is kind of open as to whether he is a he or whether whether he's called Benjamin at all. And historical records seem to point that while Benjamin was alive, he wasn't called Benjamin, and that this is sort of a myth, a story that gets built up in the years after Benjamin's death. And I think today it's impossible to talk about this individual without sort of having this myth, this story of Benjamin that gets built up after his death as part of that. And so one of the interesting parts, I think, about the story of Benjamin is how this last individual really spurs on conservation efforts in the late 20th century in Tasmania, in Australia. And Benjamin, such that he is, becomes this icon and this sort of focal point.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about the stories of endlings, the last individuals of a species amid the Earth's sixth mass extinction. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this current, what appears to be mass extinction? Do you think humans should do more to prevent the extinction of species? Is there a particular threatened species or one we've lost that you've been particularly interested in that you feel a connection to for one reason or another? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Lydia Pine, looking at her book, Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about endlings, the word for the last living individual of a species that goes extinct, and how we think about them, how we tell their stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your examples, a species of particular concern to you if you want to bring it up. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own stories if you've worked on conservation. Let's bring on a caller now. Joshua is with us in Viroqua. Joshua, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Joshua?
Yeah, so the late to great passenger pigeons, such an amazing story, and I was wondering if your guest writer had any stories about those endlings.
Joshua, thanks for the call. I don't think you have a chapter on the passenger pigeon. I don't know if we know about the last exact member of it. We've got, as I mentioned earlier, a memorial to the passenger pigeon, which once, I guess, filled the skies of North America and is now gone. Any thoughts, Lydia?
Sure. So Martha is actually the endling, the passenger pigeon endling. And there are many memorials to Martha and sort of marking this last of a species. What's really interesting, I think, about the story of Martha is that she's widely recognized, even at the point of her death and her species extinction, she's recognized as this last of her kind. But the word endling doesn't exist yet to be able to ascribe to her, to describe her. And so it the endling part of her story, I think, is one that comes much later in the 20th century. A sort of interesting factoid about Martha that I learned when I was digging into endling stories is the zoo where Martha died actually had the last two Carolina parakeets, the endling and almost endling. They were called Incas and Lady Jane. And so it's sort of an interesting coincidence that one place that's doing bird conservation work ends up with two last endlings.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's stay with birds for a moment. We had a parakeet in North America, in the United States, actually, a long time ago, the Carolina parakeet. Can you tell us about the story of what you call a charismatic endling?
I think that it is an incredibly charismatic endling and an incredibly charismatic bird. So as I mentioned, the last two endlings end up in the Cincinnati Zoo. They're Incas and Lady Jane, and they're purportedly devoted to each other. And in the tellings of these endling stories, Lady Jane dies first, and the zookeepers and conservators and curators all say that Incas had died of a broken heart and that's finally what finished him off. And I read these stories and I thought, oh my goodness, this just feels almost Arthurian in its telling, that you have this hero that's dying of a broken heart. And I felt like that was a really interesting way to think about and to frame this last Carolina parakeet.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Barneveld. Bill, hello.
Hi, great program. Taking my call. President, based here in the Salah Foundation, which is working to save what's probably the most endangered large mammal in the world now, a thing called the Salah. This looks kind of like an antelope. It was only discovered in Vietnam in 1992. You know, I get asked, you know, why are you guys trying to do this? I mean, what's, you know, there's not many of these things left. What's the point of saving this? And I just like to weigh in with an answer I often give, or my perspective is, you know, people never ask, say, the curators at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, why are you doing this? Why are you saving Van Gogh's paintings? Well, they're saving because it's this beautiful thing, his paintings, these beautiful things in the world, and the world would be much less rich without them. And the same thing for the Salah. It's this amazingly beautiful animal, and simply its beauty, that's enough reason for us. We don't have to make, you know, ecosystem economic arguments to say that just having this animal in the world a bit longer, even if we never get a chance to see it ourselves, makes the world a richer and better place.
So, Bill, thanks for that call. That's the Salah. I looked it up, S-A-O-L-A. What do you think of Bill's motivation, Lydia?
Oh my goodness, that was so beautifully put. I really appreciated him sharing his experience, and I really liked the analogy that he offered. That was really fantastic.
Thanks for calling in, Bill, at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us now in Ann Arbor. Tony, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I think that there's really not a lot of debate that we are the most invasive species on Earth. And I think that with our presence, we've caused a lot of other species to die off, or endlings. And I think we're missing a great opportunity to redirect our focus instead of trying to save the planet from global climate change, that we should just give palliative care to the people that are here now and just let us go the way of the dinosaurs and let the Earth recover after she rids herself of us.
Tony, thanks for the call. Lydia, a very drastic solution, eliminate humans from the picture. I'm guessing, I don't know, I'm assuming you're not going to jump on board with that, but short of that, do you think there's more we could do?
I think that one of the points that I think Tony raised is really interesting, in that the sort of, how do we think about bearing responsibility? And in digging through endling stories and in digging through how we talk about extinction, I think that there's definitely space for humans to assume the blame for harm that we have caused.
Tony, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lydia Pine is with us. We're talking about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. She looks at stories of the last members of species that have gone extinct and the stories we tell about them and why we tell them. Lydia, it seems to me this would be a tough project to do, right? I mean, I look at these stories and I honestly kind of want to look away. It's kind of painful and hard to confront. What kept you going to confront these stories?
It felt like, so I wrote the book during the pandemic, during the sort of first part of the pandemic, and it felt like a way to channel frustration. It felt like a way to talk about things that I felt were really hard. It felt like a way to talk about grief. But one of the other things that sort of inspired the project and spurred it on was reading a new translation of Beowulf by Maria Davanna Headley, who uses the word extinct in her translation to talk about what it is for this warrior to be the last person that survives this battle. And that moment was such an inspiration in what could literature tell us about thinking about loss and grief and the last of their kind, that I really wanted to find ways to explore that with non-human species.
Now, not all non-human species are, I guess, photogenic or charismatic. Can you make the case that we should be thinking about the other species that, may not tug at our heartstrings, that may not have that sympathetic story?
Yeah, so I can actually offer like a personal experience that was a really humbling one when I put it together. So in the book, I talk about a plant called a woods cycad. It looks sort of like a palm tree. They're not palm trees, but they look kind of like palm trees. And there's only one plant, only one of wood cycad that's in the world. But because it's a clone, there are several copies of it in various botanical gardens around the world. And I realized when I was tracking down sort of at each point, where would these individuals be, these multiple endlings, where would they be? And I realized I had actually seen one in person and hadn't realized it. And it was such a humbling experience to think, wow, because this isn't a charismatic rhinoceros or it's not a charismatic megafauna, I didn't put it together what I was seeing, the enormity of what I was seeing. And that to me was a really sobering way of understanding the role that charisma can have in species that we care about and what species stories we talk about.
Time for one more caller. Willie is with us on the line in Madison. Willie, hi.
Hi. Years ago, it was probably in the 70s, I was at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. There I saw a stuffed whooping crane, and the little caption on the bird said, there are only about 15 of the individuals of this species remaining, and the species will most certainly go extinct within the next few decades. Well, interestingly enough, I flew an airplane down to the little airport on the lake in downtown Chicago, and I flew back. And on my way flying back, I saw a flock of cranes with a few whooping cranes in it. And I realized that, you know, they talked about down to 15 in the species number at that time and that it would go extinct. It did not.
Willie, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Wisconsin, Baraboo, Wisconsin, the International Crane Foundation, a big part of whooping crane revival efforts. Lydia, Willie pointed toward a case where we came back from the brink.
I love that. It sort of offers, I think, a balance to the sadness, the trauma, and the grief that we often associate with endlings and with extinction. It's exciting to hear of success stories, I think.
Thanks for that call, Willie and Lydia. We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lydia Pine is a writer and historian. She talked with us about her most recent book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about the last living individuals of a species and how we talk about them, how we tell their stories. Still time for you to share your thoughts. If you have experiences like some of our other callers, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org.